This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. In July, the Netflix original series Orange is the New Black grabbed 12 Emmy Awards. Netflix doesn't release viewership or download numbers, but judging by the amount of buzz around the show, it's making a dent in the American zeitgeist. It's also raising awareness of some of the issues women go through in the prison system. For women who actually are in prison, it might seem a little frustrating that their lives and experiences are being interpreted through the lens of a comic drama people watch on their iPads. But in another sense, the program is highlighting a culture and a circumstance that otherwise gets very little attention. Yesterday, Vermont Law School hosted a conference that specifically looked at the challenges and issues faced by women in the correctional system, and we're going to talk about that today. Joining me in the studio is Jill Evans, Director of Women and Family Services at the Department of Corrections. Welcome to the program, Jill.
Thank you, Jane.
And Julie Brisson, Coordinator of the Wellness Workforce Coalition at the Vermont Center for Independent Living. She spent half a year in prison in Swanton for check forgery. Julie, it's a pleasure to have you with us as
well. Thank
you, Jane. I'm Jill Evans. Let's just get some basics out here so we have an understanding of the situation we're talking about.
Okay.
When women go to prison in Vermont, where do they go?
Well, currently they go to the South Burlington correctional facility called the Chittenden Regional Correctional Facility. If they're arrested in another part of the state, they might spend a night or two in the booking cell of one of our other institutions, but all of the women are housed in South Burlington.
And what's it like in there?
It's very old. It's very feels very closed in. There's very low ceilings and small spaces. It's very overcrowded. Rooms have up to four women in them. There's no natural light. There's filming on all of the windows that are there, and there's no windows that sort of open to get fresh air in. Very limited programming space at the facility. It wasn't designed to be a facility where people would do programs and serve, you know, lengthy sentences. I think the staff there are great. They do the best they can, but the reality of the physical space is that it's unfortunate that women are serving their time there.
I've been in some of the public areas in that facility. There's a gym. There's a little bit of a workout room. There are a couple places where there might be the ability to get on a computer or have some collaborative workspace. But you're saying not very much given the number of women who are living there?
Well, the gym is half of a gym because at one point they housed men in the other half of it when the men were there. They converted the other half of the gym into space for our parenting program and for a corrections industry where women are sewing. And we do have a community high school which has ample room and lots of opportunity for women who want to take classes. And there are many computers there. There's really one group space other than that. And there's a lot of resources at the Chittenden facility that were intentionally placed with the women because of the pathways that they end up in prison. So we have substance abuse services, domestic and sexual violence services, a parenting program, a vocational program, and there's a constant sort of struggle. And the other thing I think with that doesn't exist is there isn't a space that's big enough for all of the women to be in it together. And that's a very different experience from when they were in the other facilities. There were common spaces where women, for instance, in St. Albans, they could all go out in the yard together. And so a lot of women have really strong supportive relationships with each other. And I think the women at Chittenden feel very sort of isolated in their units and don't have the same ability to connect with people who they found supportive in the past.
Yeah, the women's population has moved around several times in the last decade or 15 years and has only been in the Chittenden facility for a couple of years now, since 2010. Is that right? Julie, you served in the Swanton or the St. Albans facility.
Yes, I did.
And did you find that facility was okay? Did it feel okay to be in there?
You know, I mean, this sounds kind of ridiculous, but I mean, if you had to go to jail, it was a good place to go. There was space, natural light, the windows opened, even the holding cells where you were put in when you first arrived had windows. So it was way of a more, I felt like, positive atmosphere, considering the situation.
And you said you spent one day or one evening in the Chittenden facility?
I spent 4 days in the Chittenden facility, and it was brutal. Locked in 23 hours. I wore the same clothes for 4 days. It was kind of frightening because you're off to the side because it was a male facility at the time, and you kind of hope they remember you're there.
Why does the space make a difference?
The space makes a difference because most of the ladies that are there are going to be there for a while. You're going to be there for, you know, maybe 2 weeks if you're there on a sanction or something like that, to many years. And having a healthy space with fresh air is really important. You feel claustrophobic. Your attitude gets, is affected by that. And particularly in the summer when it's hot and humid, you shove a bunch of women into a space and tempers flare.
Julie is telling us a little bit about the importance of space and tempers flaring and what's going on in a prison. Jill Evans, you talked a moment ago about some of the services that are offered in Vermont's prison system for women who are incarcerated because you said of the pathways that they get into prison in the first place. Can you talk about that?
Yes. So the research that's coming out around criminal justice involved women talks about the fact that women both end up in the criminal justice system differently than men, and they also react differently when they get into the criminal justice system. So, and the women's population tend to be much more like each other than not. So while this is sort of generalizing across a population, it is the majority of the women have experienced this trajectory. And so they have grown up in poverty. Most of them have a family member or more who've been involved in the criminal justice system and incarcerated themselves. There is a very high rate of extreme physical and sexual violence across their lifespan. Some of the studies suggest as high as 98%. And that ties into a little bit of what Julie's talking about in terms of why the space is important. So as a result of those traumatic experiences, a lot of the women also have significant mental health issues. And also, you know, in terms of living that life, many of them have become addicted to drugs or alcohol, predominantly drugs. We're seeing a lot of opiate addiction in Vermont. And so there's a lot of intersection between the mental health, the trauma, and the substance abuse issues. There's a lot of depression. So, you know, being in a closed, dark space with too many people too close to you is not the best space for people who already tend towards having a lot of mental health concerns. And we've definitely seen an increase in those symptoms since the women are at Chittenden. The other thing is that the majority of women had children, and most of them at a very young age. Most of them are single moms, and most of them had – about 75% of them had – were the primary caregiver of their kids before they ended up in prison. And the other piece that I think is huge is that they've never really developed any marketable job skills. Most of them, if they've held jobs, they've been very low skill, part-time, intermittent, not long-term employment skills. And so – these women don't really have the ability to support themselves and, start a new life kind of thing. So those are the sort of demographics of the women. And so the pathways become what are being called sort of gender survival crimes, that women predominantly commit property crimes or drug crimes, and that they tend to be related to surviving addiction, surviving poverty, or surviving domestic violence. Many women have crimes that are committed in the context of an abusive relationship.
Julie, can you talk a little bit about your story? Because your pathway is a little bit different. You're not sort of a typical woman when we talk about the demographics in that very general way. But I appreciate you being here because you're willing to talk about your experiences and why you went to prison in the first place.
Well, you know, it helps me make sense of this whole crazy situation. You know, it's like crisis becomes opportunity. I was involved in a relationship with someone who wasn't working. So we were living off my income, and, you know, I'd always had an issue with spending money. That's kind of my addictive tendency rather than running to drugs and alcohol. And, you know, it starts by writing a check, and it, you know, you don't have the money in there, but you're getting paid in a couple of days, and gradually just got out of control. And I ended up being sentenced to 90 days of work crew. Had transportation issues about trying to get from Waterbury to Barrie to do the work crew. It was costing me $100 with via taxi to get there every week. No flexibility about changing the hours, and I just couldn't do it anymore. So an arrest warrant was issued, and I discovered in Vermont, if you don't finish your work crew, you have to finish the time in jail. So I was supposed to spend 38 days there. The first time I spent roughly 109 days trying to get an approved residence. And then I was out for about 3.5 weeks in a bad living situation, stayed out all night. my PO found out, and I went back to jail for another 99 days for lack of residence.
That lack of residence, can you explain that? Because that seems like an odd one. What are you supposed to be able to have to, when you're out on furlough or when you're on probation?
The Department of Corrections has to approve where you live. You cannot live where there are any firearms. You can't live in the where people are drinking alcohol. If somebody has, you know, drugs, is using prescribed opiates or whatever. You can't live where there's another felon. There's a lot of restrictions. And not having a lot of money, I didn't have a lot of options. I got out first staying with a friend and it didn't work. And then I ended up getting out the last time with the help of Northeast Kingdom Community Action, had transitional housing money. I had some resources in jail from unemployment checks. So I was able to find, they were able to find a landlord for me. And that's how I got out.
But it sounds like that housing issue is a really big one.
It's really big. When you're in jail, all the calls you can make of that nature, you have to make with your caseworker who's managing another maybe 30 women. Also, a lot of what they do is acting like the resident director in a dorm. People are coming to them with issues about cellmates and squabbles. And you can imagine being a landlord and getting a call that says, "Hi, this call is from a correctional facility." You know, it doesn't exactly make you feel warm and fuzzy about wanting to find out who wants to rent your apartment.
Jill Evans, that's actually a really huge problem for people who are in prison, in both the male and the female population, finding suitable housing outside of prison. How many people are actually in prison because they can't find housing or because of some reason other than their jail sentence? You know, there are a lot of people who are overstaying their mandatory minimums because of some situation like that, that they can't get housing and therefore can't leave.
Yes. I can't speak to the male population. I'm sorry about that. But it is definitely a major concern for women. We've just recently done a survey of 100 women coming into the facility to try to get a sense of what some of their life situations have been. And 56% of the women had been homeless within the last several years, and 70% of them talked about having had housing problems in terms of safety. So you talk about women going to prison and being removed from what wasn't really safe, stable housing already, and then expect them to be able to find housing. And as Julie said, you know, you can only call who's on your call list, and you don't have landlords on them. And our caseworkers are very busy. We've had, you know, loss of staff through the fiscal realities over the last several years, and getting into your caseworker's office to make phone calls is difficult. That being said, you know, we are constantly looking at the population at Chittenden because we're at capacity. We're always trying to get people out. But when you look at the population who's in the facility, one of the growing cohorts are those women who are being held back past their minimum because they can't find housing. And so we have about 10 to 15% of the sentence population who have nowhere to go.
And that's why they're still in prison.
They're still in prison. You have to have an approvable release plan to get out, which includes a residence which is safe. And it's virtually impossible for some women to come up with that.
Vermont doesn't send any women out of state when they go to prison. So what happens when you reach the capacity at the Chittenden facility?
Well, right now we try to manage it on a day-to-day basis. We're looking at the head counts. We're seeing who came in, who could maybe go back out. If, you know, coming in for a work crew violation, maybe there's another sanction we can do. We try to look at the possibility of home detention, getting sentences resolved quicker. It takes a lot of time and effort to, you know, manage the population at the level that it is, and we've been doing that for about the last, well, definitely since women have been at Chittenden. We had more space at Northwest. And if you look at the trend line, it looks like our incarcerated population has stabled off and it's been fairly level. But that's because we're managing at full capacity.
We're talking today about the experiences of women in Vermont prisons and some of the challenges they face, as well as how the state is trying to manage women in the prison system and what resources are available. If you have a question, listeners, or maybe you have some experience with this in your family or personal experience that you'd like to share, our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or you can post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. On any given day, there are about 160 women behind bars in the state of Vermont, and they face some unique challenges. We're looking at those today. Julie Bisson is sharing some of her own experiences in prison. She now works for the Wellness Workforce Coalition at the Vermont Center for Independent Living. And Jill Evans, Director of Women and Family Services at the Department of Corrections, is talking about how the state treats this population. Listeners, if you have a question, you can call 1-800-639-2211. Our number again is 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post your experiences and your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. We got a note from Jim who writes, I was the carpentry instructor for the program that Vermont Works for Women ran at first at the women's prison in Windsor, Vermont, and then at the prison in St. Albans. I worked in the program until it ended with the move to Chittenden Regional Correctional Facility. Men in prison have two work camps where inmates can work at a variety of jobs, both in and out of prison. The women now have nothing like this. The work-related programming is critical. Many of these women have never had a steady job, have very few role models that had a steady job and need training in how to conduct themselves to get and keep a job. That idea that the state can release, quote, nonviolent inmates to reduce costs is simply not workable if there are not effective programs to give these women some hope that they can make their way in society. So let's talk about that. Let's talk a little bit about job training and how difficult it is to get a job when you get out of programming and out of prison. Julie, you actually work with some people who are coming out of prison and trying to figure out how to get a job, how to talk about what you could do and talk about the fact that you're coming out of prison.
And that was one of the first things I did when I first got out. And right now at with the Wellness Workforce Coalition, we're a group of 14 peer-run organizations in the state of Vermont dealing with people with mental health challenges and addiction issues. And we are working hard to come up with programming that we can bring into the facility, hopefully, and work with people when they get out around the challenges of how do you disclose your criminal record? If you need dental work, how can you get that done? Because a lot of, especially women, end up with really bad teeth. And, you know, if you have the skills maybe to be a great receptionist, chances are somebody would like somebody with a, you know, a good looking set of teeth. To things around how do you cope with dealing with people in your life that aren't the best influence for you anymore. So, and I also worked with my local community justice center. I was a member of a circle of support and accountability, a COSA, and worked with a young man for a bit over a year who kept coming in and out of the system and just trying to help him find his way and learn some coping skills. So that's an important way community members can help.
I understand this experience that you had being in prison changed your life in a couple of ways. I mean, not only it changed your career, for one thing, not only because you couldn't really go back to work in financial services, which is where you had been.
Right.
But also because of what you saw and what you experienced, you made this shift. You went back to school. Now you're working on these peer networks, helping people find and keep and retain good jobs. But why was this something that became such a passion for you?
It was... I felt a strange sense of comfort when I went to jail and peace because my life had been was so tumultuous at the time. And I probably cried every day I was there, not for myself, but for the stories I heard and from the women about the trauma in their lives and how they ended up in these circumstances. And granted, if you commit a crime, you need to do the time. And unless somebody had a gun to your head, we were doing these things voluntarily. But the wasted potential is what really got me. And when I got out, I made a promise that I would talk and be the voice for the women inside. And I feel that commitment. I mean, it's very, you know, it's embarrassing to admit you've been to jail, that you have a criminal record, that you're a felon. But I'm hoping that by talking about my experiences a little bit, it can help people see formerly incarcerated people in a different way. There are people that do deserve to be in jail for public safety, but for some people, you know, to be held for lack of residence or maybe, you know, a couple of DUIs. DUI is a terrible crime, but maybe there's better ways of treatment for that rather than just locking someone up for a year or two and hoping that they're going to resolve their problems while they're inside.
Jill Evans, you work for the Department of Corrections. Do you agree with what Julie's saying?
Absolutely. I do. You know, women in prison represent all women's issues just in a very magnified way. And so it's hard as a woman not to get really passionate about this work. Yeah, so absolutely. And the whole thing around employment, you know, as I said, that these are women who don't even have role models in their lives of women who've had careers. And so I think all of us who work with them, men included, I mean, there's nothing better than a really good man to be in a woman's life who's had this kind of a life history. But I think we as women can both champion and be advocates for them, but also role models. And that's why these job training programs and vocational skills are so important, because they don't have them. 70% of them weren't working when they came to prison. And that's because they didn't have the ability to work. There's a lot of stigma. I mean, it's always shocked me how much stigma formerly incarcerated people have from other people, but even from themselves. I mean, they feel like they have this neon thing on their head. And so it's for me, the saddest part of being at Chittenden is losing what had been happening at Northwest in terms of the employment and vocational stuff. And I think, you know,
and what had been happening, Jim talked about being a carpenter. There were some carpentry programs, home building programs at that facility because they had the space.
Yes.
And that's not happening at Chittenden.
Right. There was no space to do that at Chittenden. Jim was a great guy in the modular home program, and that program changed a lot of women's lives. But that wasn't the only program. There was a huge garden that women were becoming master gardeners, and all of the produce was going to food shelves, and all of the flowers to all of our sort of state parks and rest areas. There was a print shop, an engraving shop. There was an auto mechanic shop, so women could actually leave certified to be an auto mechanic. They were fixing Harley Davidsons, and then there were the traditional jobs like running the kitchen and cleaning and that sort of thing. But there were lots of other jobs that had really transferable skills. And we were seeing women being hired by people outside. You know, I remember one woman got a job at the Harley-Davidson dealership in Barrie because she had been repairing Harleys. And
are you seeing a difference now that women are in Chittenden in terms of what they are getting for jobs when they get out of prison?
I don't have any real concrete data or information on that.
Anecdotally?
I think they're struggling. I think that, you know, the women, for instance, we have a transitional housing program in Burlington, and it's very hard for women to get a job. A lot of them have felonies because of the amount of the check that was written or the fact that it was sale of regulated drugs. And that really affects, you know, a lot of employers aren't willing to go out on a limb and hire people like that. And they also don't have the skills they need, the soft skills, the, you know, how do you take criticism from your boss and how do you, you know, get along with coworkers. And so I think it's an area that I think we're going to be seeing more and more research about how important it is, because, you know, I think there's this notion that there's this mental illness and there's substance abuse and we have to deal with all that stuff before we get to stuff like work. And then there's this school of thought that's like, to go to work and have a day where you accomplish something and you feel good about yourself, that might be the key in whether or not you're going to relapse and how acute your mental health symptoms are. So
let's go to Jana Brown, who's calling in from Waterbury Center. She's the program manager at the Children's Literacy Foundation. Hi, Jana. What are your thoughts?
Hi, I was calling because I had the opportunity to attend the Incarcerated Women's Initiative Conference yesterday at the Vermont Law School and had a chance to hear both Jill and Julie speak. And I was calling just to describe the work that my organization, the Children's Literacy Foundation, is doing with inmates and their children across Vermont and New Hampshire. And our organization is a Vermont nonprofit, and we serve low-income and at-risk children through literacy programming, and we work, as I said, in both Vermont and New Hampshire, working with inmates and their children. And currently we are in the midst of a year-long program at the men's prison in Rutland, Vermont, and we are also doing work at the New Hampshire State Prison for Men in Concord. And we find that literacy program that we're engaging in really makes an important difference for inmates and their children and their families in general. And just to tell you a little bit more about what we do, we conduct literacy seminars to help encourage inmates to read to their children. We provide library books for the family visiting room that inmates can then use and share with their children during visits. And we also, part of the work that we're doing is supporting the prison's existing storybook programs, which allows for inmates to select children's books and then record them onto a CD or MP3 and send them home to their kids.
Jana, thank you so much for telling me about that. And, you know, that program, you can imagine right there the ability for children to hear their own parents' voices reading them a book when they can't be in the arms of their parents must be a powerful one. Jill Evans, you mentioned a little while ago that most of the women who are in prison in Vermont, and I assume elsewhere, are mothers, are parents. Charlotte asks on our Facebook page about that, saying, can you talk a little bit about what supports they're given in parenting?
So we have a parenting program and have had one for the past 14 years for incarcerated mothers, and it's called the Kids Apart Program. They're apart from their parent who's in prison, and they're a part of our communities. It's currently run out of the Lund Center. So, right, 80% of the women are mothers, and the trauma of being separated by incarceration from your child is the most significant thing that women talk about in terms of whether or not they're going to be able to do their time well. And so, and we also know that having a parent separated from you by incarceration as a child is a very traumatic event. It's considered one of the adverse childhood experiences in some of the trauma research that's been being done. So we had a really strong interest both in terms of the well-being of the children as well as women being in a place to make some positive changes to try to maintain healthy contact between mothers and children. So we have mother-child visits almost every weekend of the month where, unlike regular visiting where you're sitting with no contact tables and there's lots and lots of people and lots of noise, they're just mothers and their kids and they can have full body contact. They can sit on the floor and read. We have phone calls available for mothers who don't have money or a job to get commissary to pay for phone debit. We have grief and loss counseling for women who are really suffering with the trauma of being separated or who are actually losing their parental rights. We have other groups that happen. We have a parenting and addiction group. We have a coming home group, which is about, you know, how do you reenter, not just the issues of reentry into general community, but becoming a parent again, because parenting from prison is very different than parenting live in the community. We have a mom's mail program, and we do a lot of the children's literacy stuff. We actually recently, a woman whose mom was incarcerated for 4 years recently wrote a children's book for kids who have been experiencing this and met with the women at Chittenden who actually did the illustrations within the book. And all those books went to the kids who came in for the Mother's Day visit. It was really wonderful. So it's really important. You look at the recidivism research on men and women, and men tend to be less likely to recidivate if they have a job. Women tend to be less likely to recidivate if they have the ability to parent their children. So maintaining those connections while they're incarcerated is really important.
Julie, I see you nodding. You don't have children of your own, but you must have talked with a lot of friends who were dealing with these issues.
Exactly. Actually, one of my cellmates, who I'm still very close to, went to a hearing and had her parental rights terminated. Her child was adopted by an out-of-state relative, and as far as I know, she's still not allowed by that relative to have contact, and it's very painful. It affects all the women in the unit. It's that grief and loss. Mother's Day, I happen to be there on Mother's Day. Worst day to be incarcerated as a woman and see the pain of these women knowing that their actions have caused their children pain. And in the worst circumstances, they've lost their children because of that. And these children didn't do anything wrong. It's not their fault. And they're being punished in such a harsh way. And I think that, you know, if more people could see that, maybe it would help. I mean, you know, women panicking when the visiting hour starts and their name's not being called, you know, and then finding out that, you know, grandma couldn't bring the child, or they get there late or turned away because of the clothing somebody's wearing, because you can't wear a tank top and go in and visit and things like that. And you hear that and you think, wow.
What about for women who are pregnant? We got a couple of tweets from Allison who wants to know about the experiences of women in the system who are pregnant and what resources are out there and if they have the full range of support and medical support for their options, whether they want to choose abortion or adoption or to give birth to the child and parent that child.
Absolutely.
Jill?
It's a reality that there's a significant number of women who are pregnant while they're incarcerated, sometimes as high as 10 or 15%. We do everything we can to have a woman not deliver her child while she's incarcerated, because the reality of that is that she'll deliver the baby and within 24 hours she'll be separated and back at the facility. So we have a memorandum of understanding with Lund, and if
this is the Lund Family
the
Services
Lund Family
based
Center,
in Burlington.
Yes. If women meet the criteria and we can and their sentence structure is appropriate, they can actually be released on a medical furlough to serve their time at Lund and deliver their baby there. Our parenting program, because it comes from Lund, Lund also has an adoption side of their agency. So if there's lots of support and guidance around electing to terminate a pregnancy, choosing to put a child up for adoption. We have an excellent medical center at the facility. We have a woman who's a nurse practitioner who specializes in women's health. And, you know, we look at all the women who come in pregnant as high-risk pregnancies because of the pathways that I talked about. And so they're if they're opiate addicted, they're brought to the hospital and they're made part of the CHARM program, and they can get inducted with Suboxone. And if women come in on that, they're maintained on it, and they go to the high-risk pregnancy clinic. They leave the facility and go there for specialized services.
Allison also tweeted us to see if we could have a little bit of a discussion about how transgender inmates are treated in Vermont. Julie, do you have experience with that in the system, talking about gender and gender identity? You know, is that something that goes on?
Well, it actually did while I was incarcerated, because we had a gentleman who was transitioning but still had female genitalia. So he ended up coming into the living unit I was living in, which was interesting because you had somebody male, you know, I would say teenaged male, and then that in the transition process, that's how he appeared, living with a bunch of women. So he was very popular. But it was a real challenge about sharing, you know, bathroom and shower facilities and things around that. He wasn't there for very long, but it kind of disrupted the whole unit. People moved around to be able to give him his own cell. And I'm sure he wasn't, you know, totally comfortable either, you know, being there. So hopefully this is something that, you know, the Department of Corrections will continue to look at as you know, this is a population and also a risk population, you know.
What is the policy, Jill Evans?
We don't have a policy that's in full effect at this point. We have been drafting a policy over the last 6 months or so. And I think the department has gotten much better at working with people who are trans. At the present time, I think that's sort of handled on a case-by-case basis, and I think the default tends to be that what their genitalia are is the facility that they go to, but we're having conversations about gender identity, about where and a transition that they might be, and about their safety and their comfort, and security staff's concerns about safety and comfort. So, you know, hopefully long gone are the days when people who came in who were trans were maybe segregated in our facilities and kept in a lockdown situation where they were locked up for 23 hours out of the day.
I want to ask both of you in the time we have left a really pointed question. You've both been thinking about these issues. You were at the conference at Vermont Law School yesterday talking about women in prison and women's issues and how the state could do better. Is Vermont doing well by its women who are in the system, and what do you want to see to make it better? Julie, I'm going to start with you.
I would say that they're trying, but there's a lot more that needs to be done and a lot less discussion, a lot more action. Jill and her team, the Incarcerated Women's Initiative in 2007, hit the nail on the head. And unfortunately, you know, we're still having these same discussions.
Jill?
Well, there's lots of things that we could be doing better, even though I think we're doing good with what we have. I think our commissioner's office has sort of a renewed interest and commitment to gender responsivity within the department. They've asked me to draft a policy, and I think a policy will ensure that things start to happen. But I think the conversation yesterday, unilaterally, I think people thought that what we were doing back in the late 2000s was what we should start doing again.
And because this initiative lasted for a little while and was canceled.
It was three years and then it ended. And I think there were a lot of legislators there, and there's some interest in possibly creating a commission on incarcerated women so that the conversation doesn't end, that it's not up to whoever's in leadership or in a position to keep forcing the issue, but to have it be part of our infrastructure. Because the reality is, if you don't specifically talk about the women, they're invisible in the larger correctional population.
Well, I hope you'll both keep us posted as things move forward, and I really appreciate you taking the time to be with us today.
Thank you, Jay.
Thank you for having us.
We've been speaking today with Jill Evans, who's the Director of Women and Family Services at the Department of Corrections, and Julie Brisson, who's the coordinator of the Wellness Workforce Coalition at the Vermont Center for Independent Living. Coming up, two leading researchers on honeybees will tell us about pesticides and how that may be contributing to population die-offs. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Bees are essential to our agricultural infrastructure and food production. For the better part of a decade, a devastating problem has caused massive die-offs in the honeybee population. The term colony collapse disorder has been attached to this phenomenon, but two leading bee experts say CCD is just one part of a much wider problem affecting bees, butterflies, bats, and other pollinators. Marianne and Jim Fraser are bee experts from Penn State University, and they'll be in Vermont tomorrow to give a talk on their research. When I spoke with them this morning, they explained how CCD fits into the bigger picture of bee health.
Yes, I think the term was coined originally to describe what was thought to be a new phenomenon. And as we've begun to look at the interaction of multiple factors that could be contributing to this, I think the evolving view among researchers is that the symptoms characteristic of CCD is just one special situation that is representative of a broader spectrum of interactions of factors, that all of which lead to declines of bees. And because it's multiple factors interacting, pesticide residues, diseases, parasitic mites, viruses, because these things can be at different levels at different times, and each colony has a different history of what they've done, it makes doing cause and effect experiments very challenging. And so it's a very difficult research agenda. It's kind of like trying to unravel the cause of cancer with about, you know, 1/100th of the researchers and 1/1000th of the money available to do it. So it's really a difficult situation.
Marianne Fraser, that's part of your research, is doing these experiments and trying to look at the impact of various things on the bees. And you look specifically at pesticides. Can you talk about your research?
It's interesting. There are a lot of folks now who are involved in the work on pesticides. It's a very complex, difficult area of research. But our work originally was to look at CCD, non-CCD colonies, sick colonies, healthy colonies, and look at the pesticide load in those colonies. And it was pretty shocking to us when we looked at the spectrum of colonies across the country, the diversity and levels of pesticides that we were seeing coming into honeybee colonies. It was significant. And once we figured out that, yes, pesticides are an important part of this picture in terms of honeybee health, now the question is, you know, what role are they playing? How are they impacting the health of individual bees, of colonies, and of honeybee populations and pollinator populations? So that in and of itself is an incredibly complex and difficult question to answer, in part because the pesticides are not there singly, they're there multiply. On average, we find 6 pesticides per colony in the pollen, which is the protein source that bees use, particularly to feed their brood, their babies. And so when you have multiple pesticides with multiple modes of action, there's concern about interaction. So that's one big issue that we face. The other is that pesticides don't always kill bees outright. Sometimes they do if they're exposed to a toxic level, but oftentimes they're exposed to what we call sublethal levels, which are levels that can do things like reduce their lifespan, interfere with their ability to communicate and forage and navigate, interfere with their physiology, like maybe the development of some of their glands. And so these sublethal effects are sort of very insidious and can cause colonies to decline, but over a period of time, and you might not recognize them as the impacts of pesticides. And the last big area that we in our particular lab are really interested in are the inert ingredients that are part of pesticide formulations. Oftentimes, these inerts are actually the major component of the formulation, as opposed to the active ingredient, which might be present at a very small percentage of the formulation. And it turns out that these inert ingredients, which are not disclosed and are often not regulated, are in fact toxic to non-target organisms. So this is a big area of concern and one that we're really focused on right now.
Given the research that you're doing and what you're finding out about how these pesticides affect bee populations and pollinator populations, are you at the point where you are ready to come out and make recommendations or suggest regulations? Because obviously, pesticide use is a huge part of industrial agriculture in the United States.
Yeah, I've been acting as a science advisor to the National Honeybee Advisory Board, which is a group of some of the largest beekeepers in the country who are speaking for the two national organizations. And for the last 7 years, we've been interacting with people at EPA on a quite regular basis, trying to increase their awareness of the problems that beekeepers are facing, the role of pesticides, some of the limitations in the risk assessment process that are used to register pesticides. Limitations in the language that's on the label that people use to direct how they apply pesticides. There are a lot of difficulties that need to be overcome, and we've been working diligently trying to get EPA's cooperation in making these changes.
It sounds like you've been working towards it, but don't feel like you've completely got the EPA on your side on this?
No, we're a long way from having the situation solved. They're just so many things in place that are difficult to change that the pace of change is glacial with respect to the needs for change in the field on an annual basis. Beekeepers are still losing significant numbers of bees each year. We estimate that they've spent more than $1.2 billion of their own money to replace lost bees over the last 6 years. That's been almost completely uncompensated by any government program to help them out. So they've really been hung out there on their own.
In the absence of federal regulation, you would need to get farmers who are using pesticides and or the pesticide manufacturers to change their ingredients. Do you see either of those things happening?
Well, yes, that's a very good point. In fact, we've been working together with producers and producer groups and with the pesticide industry representatives to try to make these changes. Everyone has a slightly different perspective, as you might guess. Most farmers want to do the right thing, but they're not always sure what the right thing is or what the timing needs to be. The pesticide manufacturers are willing to make changes, and they're working to make some of those changes. But, of course, they've got a huge investment in the products that are already in the marketplace, and trying to get those removed, even if there are problems associated with them, has many barriers to try to make that happen. So it is a team effort to some extent. It could certainly be smoother than it is, but I think everyone is aware of the problem and trying to address it in their own individual ways.
Jim and Marianne, when you travel to places like Vermont to give talks about bees, what do you tell people who are interested in bees and worried about this issue about what they can actually do to have an impact?
Yeah, it's interesting. There are things that people can do. For one thing, you know, it's become quite fashionable to have lawns that are green without any, dandelions or clover. And in fact, those are, you know, important sources of nutrition for pollinators. And so we try to get people to think about more responsible use of pesticides, in particular herbicides. It turns out that, you know, like everything else, habitat is being lost. And in the case of pollinators, that habitat is, blooming plants and flowers. So the other thing is planting for pollinators, actually thinking about turning your lawn into a pollinator garden, or at least a piece of your lawn into a pollinator garden, someplace that's really friendly for, you know, monarch butterflies and bumblebees, that kind of thing. So by using, you know, responsible use of herbicides and planting for pollinators, we think that this can really be beneficial to pollinator populations. And people can also buy honey from local beekeepers. So I think people being aware of the food supply, being aware of where their food comes from and how important pollinators are, just understanding the food supply and how important these components are, the roles that they play, is important.
Mary Ann Frazier is a researcher with Penn State's Extension Service. Jim Frazier is a professor emeritus of entomology at Penn State. They will be giving a presentation tomorrow evening at the Echo Center in Burlington on the causes and controversies of the illnesses affecting honeybees. You can find more information about their talk at vpr.net. Just click on Vermont Edition. Jim and Mary Ann, thank you very much for speaking with me.
It's our pleasure.
Thank you for having us.
And that wraps up today's show. You've probably heard the flocks of geese flying overhead already. That means it's time for our fall bird show. Tomorrow, we'll talk about how climate change may affect Vermont's bird populations. And bird diva Bridget Butler answers your questions. Send them to Vermont Edition at vpr.net and join us at noon. Our producers are Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sage Van Wing. We have production assistance from Aaron Lucy. Mary Williams directed the show. Our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.